Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we are looking at Senator Orrin Hatch's announcement from earlier this week that he will retire after the end of this term, that he's not standing for re-election next year. And of course, we'll turn to widespread speculation around whether Mitt Romney will run for Hatch's seat. Plus, the Mormon Church mourns the passing of its president, Thomas S. Monson. We'll hear about Monson's life and legacy and about his apparent successor. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Dan, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack, that is. Good morning, Peggy, and thanks for being here as well.
Hi.
On the phone from Washington, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and welcome to you, Tommy.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
And coming back to the studio, Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Glad you're here, Robert.
Thank you. Good morning.
As always, we want to hear from our listeners. If you've got questions or comments about the stories that we are covering today, you can post them at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us up. We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's start with Senator Orrin Hatch's announcement earlier this week that this term will be his last. Just last week on this show, I think most of the guests who were present were predicting that Senator Hatch would stand for another term, for an eighth term. And there are some reasons behind the thinking, and we'll get to those reasons in a little bit. But in the end, that didn't happen. Hatch is going to retire. And maybe I'll start with Thomas Burr in Washington. Tommy, was this a surprise? Was it expected? You know, none of the above?
You know, it's funny. It's almost depends on when you asked Hatch whether he's going to run again. He really was hemming and hawing. Depending on, like, you know, at 9 a.m. I could ask him and he was going to run, and 4 p.m. he was not going to run. So I think we're all kind of finally surprised that he made the official announcement and said he's not going to run. But, you know, he's been considering this for a while. His wife did not want him to run, for sure. He's been getting pressure from, you know, President Trump and other senators to stay in the seat. At the end of the day, he decided he wanted to, you know, end on a good note, bow out, and go spend time with his family. Let's also think, you know, he's not going to disappear. He's still going to be around. He's going to focus on the Hatch Center, which is a place where his archives are going to go, where he's going to, you know, kind of have like a forum, like a, you know, a new generation of leaders kind of thing. So he'll still be around. But, yeah, in some ways it's a shocking development that he's not going to run. But at least we finally have the decision rather than, yes, he's running, no, he's not running, a thing we've been dealing with for months.
Right, being uncertain. Robert Gerke, news columnist, let's go to you. I think that you and I both last week predicted that Hatch would run again. This week you wrote a column about his Hatch's decision-making process, about how he kept everyone guessing.
Yeah.
And was there any single driving factor behind Hatch's decision? Tommy points to going out on a high note.
Yeah, I mean, I think he, as Tommy mentioned, the family aspect of it was really important to him. I mean, people back in Utah have been working on this Hatch Center that they're going to be kicking off. I think it's going to be, the assumption is it'll be in conjunction with the University of Utah, and it's going to be sort of the, you know, a place for Hatch's papers and for research and things like that. Mm-hmm. But they've been working on that for quite a while. But he was still, you know, as recently as middle of December, early December, when Trump came to town, was telling people in public settings back in D.C. and here that he was going to run again. And so there was sort of this sense that, yeah, this is, he had said he was not going to run again in 2012. He had kind of been saying, well, I'm going to, you know, he was reconsidering, and he was a little reluctant to be shown the door, I guess. I think the family aspect of it, though, I mean, again, his health is not great. His wife, Elaine, her health is worse than his. Orrin has issues with his eyesight. You know, he's 83. He's, you know, his memory maybe isn't what it used to be, fatigue and so forth. But he was, you know, teed up to run again. And then I think once the tax bill passed that he had been working on for so long and had taken up so much of his time, and once Bears Ears was done, once Trump's executive order had shrunk the monument, you know, it was kind of a time for him that he could go out on top, you know, and on his own terms.
You know, I'm talking to Salt Lake Tribune staffers here, and the Trib on Christmas Day had this blistering editorial calling for Hatch to resign. At the same time, the paper named him Utahn of the Year for the influence that he wielded in 2017. The Trib essentially urged the senator to go out on a high note, and I'm not saying that he heeded the newspaper's advice, but that leaving with a string of successes, Dan Harry, especially when the future is maybe murky, and we can get to that in a minute, that's part of his calculus, was going out having accomplished all this, as Robert Gehrke points to.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of people urging him to get out. Robert had a really interesting point in his column, which I thought was very informative. If you haven't read it, you should. Was one reluctance was that a lot of Mitt Romney folks were involved in setting up and fundraising for this center.
Right.
And so there was a reluctance to make it look like he was succumbing to the Romney people to get out. So that was an interesting...
Sort of holding the door open for... So there were funders. Tell us about this, Robert Gehrke. Well, there were funders for this center who have been backers of Mitt Romney in the past, and maybe they're kind of opening a door for Senator Hatch to walk through and for Romney to walk into.
Yeah, I mean, they were sort of orchestrating this transition of power. I mean, you've got people like Kim Gardner, who's one of Romney's closest friends, who was helping establish this Hatch Center. And it was interesting because, and Tommy can speak to this as well, I think, but each time there was a new story in the media about people, Romney people, who were getting frustrated with Hatch taking too long, we saw Orrin sort of reflexively say, oh, well, I'm going to run again, you know, or I'm probably going to run again, you know, and he would sort of reiterate that he wasn't getting out. And every time they'd put heat on him, put pressure on him to get out, he would say he wasn't getting out. And I think once they gave him a little bit, gave him space and sort of let him, you know, reach that decision with his family, I think it became a lot more straightforward for him.
The Hatch Center aspect of that and Romney funders or people who have backed Romney, Gehrke mentioned Ken Gardner, also Scott Anderson from Zions Bank. Are they really trying to maneuver Hatch? Is that a cynical view of things, or is that just politics? I don't know.
Well, Tommy can address this more, but I know that Orrin Hatch has, you know, put a lot of thought into this center. I mean, he sees this as part of his legacy, and I think it's a very important thing to him. So, yeah, I think that all mattered. I wanted to ask Robert, because he's an opinion guy, so he can give his opinion on this. Do you think if Hatch had declared that he would seek an eighth term, would Mitt Romney still have run?
No, I mean, I think the Romney people had made pretty clear that they weren't going to challenge Hatch. And, you know, and there have been some people who have been speculating that Hatch got out because he thought he was going to lose. And I think that's nonsense. I mean, Orrin Hatch, if he was going to run again, he was going to win. And his poll numbers were bad, but his poll numbers were bad 6 years ago. And, you know, once the Orrin Hatch political machine gets going, you know, as I tweeted last night, he grinds people into dust and snorts it like Scarface. You know, he was going to steamroll whatever opposition was there, except for, you know, Mitt Romney. And I think, if the Romney people weren't going to run against him, then it became his path. The Orrin's path to election was just as clear as it was 6 years ago. And, you know, it wasn't a matter of a threat to him that he was going to lose. It was a matter of just the timing being right for him to get out.
What about there's been polling that shows that a majority of Utahns didn't want him to run again.
Three quarters, I think, of Utahns didn't.
95%.
Didn't want him to run again. But last time he ran, it was close to 70%. So, and he still won by about 30 points. So, it wasn't a matter of any real risk or threat to his reelection.
And we watched earlier last year that one of the other potential threats to Orrin Hatch's reelection was John Huntsman Jr.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there was the appointment as an ambassador to Russia. So that took that threat out of.
And another name that had been mentioned was Matt Holland, UVU President Matt Holland, and he's now on a Mormon mission. So those people conveniently got taken off the field. Mitt Romney had said he wasn't going to run against him. There was really no threat.
Thomas Burr in Washington, what about all of the fundraising that Senator Hatch has been doing? His campaign raised a lot of money. Where does that money go now, and how much money are we talking about?
Yeah, and fact, so he has $4.7 million in the bank already, and he has a fundraiser today, actually, up in Park City. So, you know, he's not stopping, but that money could be technically, I think there's a way to make it go towards the Hatch Center. I think that they've got plenty of funders for that as well. But he has a very big bank account, and obviously he's not stopping by doing something this weekend. But in some ways, that money is still going to be there for what Hatch wants the purposes to be there for.
You know, we haven't heard just Peggy Fletcher Stack, who's here with us, religion reporter. Does someone like Hatch, who is an active member of the LDS Church, does he consult with religious leaders before he makes decisions like this?
I have no idea.
Yeah, you probably don't know that. Tommy?
No, that's a really interesting question. I've been asked a couple times, does this faith inform this decision? I think, someone's faith always informs someone's decision. But, we see the Mormon apostles are obviously elderly, and they get there by seniority. Hatch probably didn't think this is some way he's not getting called on a mission, but he might have informed him in some ways. But I think it comes back to the family thing. His wife didn't want him to run, and sometimes you got to listen to the wife.
Well, and can age be a factor here? I mean, the Senate is old; it's the oldest Senate in the history of the Senate. Senator Hatch is 84 years old. I don't think we need to discount people because of their age, but maybe in the back of his mind, was that a factor?
I mean, I think it could have been, and I think it was more of a concern for his kids. You know, Brent Hatch, from what I understood, has had some pretty frank conversations with his dad about not running again, and so, that's his oldest son. You kind of listen to your kids, and I think the question about the religion is actually pretty interesting, because not only is Utah losing a senior member of the Senate, you know, he's the most senior Republican. He's the third in line in succession for the presidency. You know, he's got the seniority in the finance chairmanship, but he was also a good pipeline for the LDS Church. I mean, on countless occasions, he, helped the church with concerns that they had and issues that they had. And so, not only is the state losing a senior member of the Senate, a very influential member of the Senate, but, the door, the conduit that the church had to that, to those halls of power, I guess, is also going. Not that the other members of the delegation aren't going to help the church. They're a powerful constituent. But
yes, and Senator Bob Bennett famously was a good conduit as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I do know that Mitt Romney, before he ran for president, did consult with church leaders. That was a whole different deal, but he definitely asked, not permission, but just...
Sure, Thomas Burr, too, you can weigh in on that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Peggy. If I can break in with some breaking news, actually. Apparently, President Trump called Romney last night. I'm just pinged the White House about this, but Trump called Romney to discuss this race, which would be fascinating to have heard that conversation.
And I want to get, it would have been great to be a fly on the wall. I want to get to Romney and whether or not he's going to run. He hasn't obviously declared that he's going to run yet.
He's going to run.
But Robert Kirky says yes.
Robert, you're not so good at predicting things.
That's true.
Well, so Romney has been a strong critic of President Trump at least in this last year. Senator Hatch, and also President Trump's first year in office, so this makes sense. There's been a close relationship, a relationship at least between Donald Trump and Senator Orrin Hatch. Maybe close isn't the right word, but they had fond words for each other. The president was not the first choice of most Utah Republicans in the Republican primary last year. Dan Harry, did that make? I mean, apparently Hatch wasn't vulnerable. Is this true, or could that have been a vulnerability for him in an upcoming election?
Well, I don't think Senator Hatch saw it as a vulnerability. I mean, I think there were people in the Republican Party that kind of were, repulsed by the effusive praise that the senator showered on the president. The president, of course, loves that kind of praise. But, I don't think in the final count in the election, if Mitt Romney hadn't run against him, I don't think it would have made a difference to Hatch's reelection. Mm-hmm.
There's 41 years of Senate history that I want to kind of dip into, but we do need to go to our first break of the show. When we return, we will keep talking about the legacy of Orrin Hatch and turn to the potential of a run by Mitt Romney. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, news columnist Robert Gerke, and religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Join us with your questions and comments during this Friday morning conversation at sltrib.com, the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-8255. And before the break, we were talking about the tenure and the future of Senator Orrin Hatch, who announced that he won't run for re-election this year. And I want to get back to his time in the Senate. Senator Hatch fought a lot of battles. He had an influential role on a number of influential committees, and he helped shape the judiciary. Tommy Burr in Washington, he went to bat, for example, for Clarence Thomas when he was getting confirmed, and it was in the midst of controversy.
Absolutely. No, you have to think about this. There's not a single person on the Supreme Court right now that Orrin Hatch didn't have his hands in helping get there. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example, was somebody that actually Hatch suggested to President Clinton to nominate. Hatch has had an influence on a lot of things. The American Disabilities Act, children's health care. He worked with Senator Kennedy. He was famous for actually working across the aisle with Senator Kennedy for a long time on those things. The senator has, 41 years in a day, 2 days, I think, actually, he's been in the Senate. It's pretty impressive. No one, I have to look at this, but I think he has the record for passing the most legislation of any senator, and he is the longest-serving Republican in the U.S. in U.S. history. People bring up Strom Thurmond, but Strom Thurmond was a Democrat at one point, so Hatch will definitely be retiring with a legacy that is that's pretty amazing.
You know, Robert Gerke, Tommy brings up the reaching across the aisle, his famous friendship with Senator Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that's Hatch from a bygone era or the Senate from a bygone era, for that matter. Because
that's an excellent question. There was a really interesting columnist in the New York Times that opined about this and pointed out how when Hatch came into office, he considered himself to be a moderate, you know, and he worked with Senator Kennedy on the Ryan White AIDS Act. He worked with him on a children's health insurance program. He was a bipartisan senator and a legislator and sort of, you know, hewed to the traditions of the Senate and working across the aisle. He worked, as Tommy mentioned, on the Supreme Court nominees. And now, you know, the Hatch that we see now is very different, and the Senate's very different. It's a much more partisan, and part of that is these pressures on him to move right that arose with the Tea Party and the defeat of Senator Bennett. And now we see an Orrin Hatch who is, you know, we can't reauthorize CHIP because it's now a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. And we can't, you know, and we see an Orrin Hatch who won't work with Democrats on this tax legislation. And it's just a different Senate. It's a different senator. And you know, I think it's a very different
author of CHIP,
time.
Author of the Dream Act.
Right, right. You know, and Washington's a different place. I mean, we used to, and we did with Orrin Hatch, say, okay, here's his legacy. Here are the bills that he passed. You don't do that now with our members of our delegation or other members of Congress. When Jason Chaffetz left office after 8 years, there really wasn't a bill you could point to that he passed.
Yeah, he passed like four pieces of legislation, including post office namings or something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
it's it's not part of their legacy. Bob Bennett, Orrin Hatch, they came from a different era. They actually like, okay, here are the things we did. You can't say that now. It's they don't do things.
Well, I mean, again, we can point to this last year because of the makeup of the presidency and the Senate having Hatch an effect. As we pointed out, mm-hmm. Hatch was named Utah of the Year because he was able to do certain things, but not in a bipartisan way necessarily.
Yeah, no, not bipartisan. Yeah.
Sheer
at all.
Sheer power and will. Yeah.
Thomas Burr, I know you have to go here pretty soon, but I'd like to get this question in. Hatch has, of course, a year of his tenure left. What is he going to do during this year? Do we know?
Sure, and I want to pivot back to Romney for a second, if I can, as well. But you know, there are several things on the agenda this year. I mean, one, Congress has a lot to do in the next month. But if we want to talk about what Hatch wants to finish off, you know, there's the entitlement reform, which we should be careful talking about that because there'll be major changes to things like Social Security, Medicaid, and that's something that's definitely, you know, on his agenda to try to get done when we have a Republican in the White House and Republicans controlling Congress. You know, there are still some questions about the tax reform stuff. There's some fixes that need to happen. But going back to Romney real fast, this is for the Sunday paper, by the way, if you want to read the Salt Lake Tribune. Why would Romney want to run? In some ways, you could look at this and say he would be a junior senator from Utah to Mike Lee. He would have no seniority to be any, you know, committee on any of the, you know, amazing committees, the powerful committees. But we also have to think about Romney maybe doesn't want the first line of his obituary to read, you know, twice failed presidential candidate. Maybe he wants to stand up and be like, you know, I did something when my country needed me. Whether he's going to be continuing to be a never Trumper kind of person and always calls out the president, we'll see about that, because if Romney does run, you can't be a one-note person who's always going to be, you know, critical. But if you look at the Senate, we're losing Senator Hatch. Senator McCain, sadly, you know, has brain cancer. Senator Cochran is not doing well. We're kind of losing a lot of the statesmen we kind of thought about who would stand up in the Senate floor and demand attention because of who they are. Romney would be that figure.
Well, and he was the standard bearer of the party not that long ago. I mean, despite the fact that they were not successful presidential runs, he was the person who was leading the Republican Party in that sense. Will he be opened? Will he be opened? Will he be welcomed with open arms by Republican senators if he does get elected? I mean, and he runs, that is.
I assume so. I talked to Senator Cornyn, who's the majority whip, the other day in the Senate, and he very much was encouraging Romney to run. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, I think would probably welcome him. Certainly there'd be some people who would not be so excited to see him join the kind of the pro-Trump crowd, because Romney has been so critical of the president. But in some ways, you know, what Romney is somebody that the party rallied around, like you said, a few years ago, and he still has a lot of supporters there. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, was his running mate.
Of course. Yeah. Dan Harry, there's a sort of sense of inevitability, a kind of feeling that Romney is this, you know, the anointed one. Even Hatch talked about stepping aside if Romney was going to run or kind of giving his seat over to Romney. Is this inevitable? Are there other Republicans who, you know, who could challenge him in a primary and win?
You know, based on polling, I wouldn't think so. Like I said, the one real threat was John Huntsman Jr., and he's been taken out of the equation. So, yeah, it does really feel like a kind of...
Should we just save the expense of the election?
You know, almost so. It's kind of like, is this the way democracy is supposed to work?
That was the point I was just going to make. I mean, it's kind of a lousy way to figure out our next representatives in Washington because, you know, this transition of power, this naming your own successor and sort of this, you know, Orrin Hatch has held this seat for four decades, and there's been a clot in the artery, you know, this logjam of these people who want to run for this seat and put talented political people and young political people, and instead we're getting this anointment of Mitt Romney, which I think Dan's right. I don't think there's any way anybody beats him. He got 72% of the vote last time he was on the ballot. You know, he'll probably get roughly that same vote in November if he decides to run, which obviously I think he is. But yeah, where's you know, sort of the next generation of visionary leaders there? It's you know, and the other thing that is kind of irritating, frankly, you've got this rocky relationship between the White House and Mitt Romney, and that's going to hurt Utah. Mitt Romney, I don't think, cares about Utah issues. He's not going to be a senator from Utah. He's going to be a U.S. senator who happens to represent Utah, you know. And you know, he's going to be more concerned about his prominence on the national stage than he is about getting funding for a road project in San Juan County. I don't see him being, and then he's going to serve for 6 years, maybe 12, but probably just six, and then leave, and you know, because otherwise he's going to be the same age as Orrin Hatch at that point, and Utah's going to be left again with this sort of, you know, the lack of prominence in Washington. It's not helpful to Utah for to have this sort of anointment, but that's the way it is.
Well, and I feel
Robert,
like,
are you going to run yourself?
Yeah, Gerke.
Vote Gerke.
Yeah, exactly. Thomas, I know you have to go here in a second, but just a lot of Republicans are waiting to find out from the non-Utah perspective whether or not Romney will be someone who continues to stand up to President Trump when he's in the Senate. I mean, he has been an outspoken critic of the president and, you know, as he was running, called him a phony and a fraud and someone who lacked the I can't remember what it was, the exact quote, but there's a quote that Romney had.
Yeah, and more recently, he's taken issue with him on things like Charlottesville and climate
Moore.
Change and Roy Moore. Yeah,
immigrants, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's put it this way. Romney has till March 15 to decide whether he's going to run or not. But talking to people in Mitt's orbit, it sounds like he's going to decide in the next couple of weeks. He's not going to, tease us for a while and say, I'm running or I'm not running. He in the next couple weeks, he's probably going to announce he's going to test the waters, which pretty much means he's in. We'll know because he doesn't want to hold other people up on deciding whether they're going to run again. But all indications to help Robert's prediction, it sounds like he's going to run.
I'm wondering, does anyone know the last time that someone was governor and senator from two different states? I mean, has that ever happened? Great trivia. We'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
Actually, I heard this last night. There was one person who was governor of one state, senator, and then governor of another. That was Sam Houston. He was a senator from, I think, Tennessee, and then, governor of Texas, and also the president of the Republic of Texas at one point.
Okay. Well, we have other topics that we will have to move on to here pretty soon, but I want to, I know that Tommy, you have to go, so Thomas, thanks. Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks.
We haven't even talked about the Democratic side, the people who are going to be challenging Hatch on the Democratic side. There are a couple of candidates waiting in the wings. Jenny Wilson, the daughter of someone who actually ran against Orrin Hatch. This is former Salt Lake City Mayor Ted Wilson, Dan
Harry. Right, very popular Salt Lake City mayor, and he ran against Orrin Hatch, I think it was 1982, and actually performed better than any Democrat since, but he still lost in a landslide. I think it was a 17-point margin that he lost by.
Okay.
Jenny's well-known in mainly the Salt Lake area. She's run for Salt Lake City mayor. She's now serving on the Salt Lake County Council. And, the county is the largest population in the state. But if you go beyond Salt Lake County, I think that that cachet wears off awfully quick. So, who knows? Anything can happen, right? But according to the polling, you would say that it's going to be Republican. And if Mitt Romney's on the ballot, it's going to be Mitt Romney. There was an interesting story we had today. Unfortunately, I thought kind of got buried, which was there's a super PAC that supported Roy Moore in Alabama. And they are now kind of turning their sights on Mia Love, suggesting that she run for Hatch's seat and saying that she is the true conservative and that they just really blast Mitt Romney, calling him Hillary Clinton's best friend, which, is wrong in a couple of regards. just painting him with a very rhino brush. So I don't know if that has any traction, but this group does have a lot of money, so who knows?
Who knows?
Mia Love, disavowed it, said she wanted nothing to do with this group. But there has, her name has been mentioned as a potential candidate. Mm-hmm. Chris Stewart is another one that's been mentioned.
I'm just sorry, Rhino, Republican in name only, in case anybody out there doesn't know that.
It was a bad break for the Democrats, I think, when Hatch retired, because as much of a hole, as much of an underdog as they would be going against Hatch, I think it's much harder. There's less vulnerability there from a potential Romney candidacy.
Huge name recognition.
Huge name recognition, huge money, widespread popularity. If it was a difficult task for Democrats to win the Senate seat before, I think it got much, much harder with Hatch's retirement.
There's Jenny Wilson announced back in July that, that could conceivably kind of give her a head start there. But again, going up against Mitt Romney would be difficult. There's another Democrat, Mitchell Weiss, not as well known as Jenny Wilson. Dan or Gerke, do you guys know his story?
I do know.
I don't either. Sorry.
All right. Well, we'll figure that out at some point. And we'll know soon enough whether or not Romney is going to run, as Tommy pointed out, before March 15th. We need to move on to some other topics from this past week's news, but maybe we should head to another break here quickly before we do that. Monumental news, actually, from this past week, the passing of LDS Church President Thomas S. Monson. We'll come to that when we return in a moment. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Peggy Fletcher Stack, Dan Harry, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning wrap-up of the week's top news. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. And to religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack now, who can talk about the other big news of the week, the passing of LDS Church President Thomas S. Monson, who died at the age of 90. Peggy, to start with, maybe you can tell us when Monson took over, when he took charge of the church, and where he came from. What was his personal background and his experience within the church before he was chosen to lead it?
So he became the LDS Church's prophet, seer, and revelator, which is what Mormons believe their leader is, in 2008,
right,
at the death of Gordon B. Hinckley. And he was one of the longest-standing apostles in the church. He was named an apostle when he was 36 years old. Utah, Salt Lake boy, very charismatic, grew up on the west side of Salt Lake City. As a young man, fairly young man, I think 23, he was a Mormon bishop on the west side, and he had 82 widows in his Mormon congregation, which thing he referred to repeatedly throughout his tenure. And as I said in my obituary of him, he really never stopped being that Mormon bishop. He was a real caretaking kind of guy, nurturing, was always mentioning stories about caring for homeless and needy folks, visiting hospitals, etc. That was his public persona.
Well, you mentioned, you know, that caring for homeless people, an early sort of tidbit from his upbringing was the idea that hobos, you know, people from the street were known to go to his house because his mom would sort of make sandwiches or whatever. That was an interesting story, I thought.
That was a story he told quite often over the pulpit. And as people have said, his sermons, the tone of his sermons and the substance hardly ever changed. You could hear a sermon from the 1950s and a similar sermon from the 1990s or the 2000s, and they were the same. Folksy, charming, referring to some popular musical or something like that. People liked it because it was very different than lots of other church leaders.
You know, you mentioned that he came into his position in 2008, and that coincides with the first presidential run of someone we were just discussing, Mitt Romney. The country had a kind of Mormon moment during his leadership. Did he play a role in kind of shaping that moment?
You know, the funny thing is, actually, most people would say no, that a lot of things happened during this decade of his presidency, including the Mormon moment, Mitt Romney's run, the Book of Mormon musical, lampooning Mormons. Proposition 8 was one of the very first things that happened in his presidency, in which he urged Mormons in California to work for Proposition 8 about gay marriage in California. Also some other well-known controversies during his time.
Right.
And yet President Monson himself never really was identified with those issues. A scholar on our podcast, the Tribune's podcast, Mormonland, compared him to Ronald Reagan, a guy who made a lot of speeches, was a popular speaker, but not so closely associated with the controversies of his era, that's sort of Tom Monson as well.
And I thought the contrast between his tenure as president and Gordon B. Hinckley's as president, Gordon B. Hinckley was obviously a much more high profile, out in front kind of face for the church, and then Thomas Monson was sort of more of a behind the scenes. You know, you'd see him at conference, but outside of that, he didn't do a lot of public.
Well, think about this. Gordon Hinckley, in his first year, was interviewed by probably every national reporter. Mm-hmm. Thomas Monson, in his 10 years, gave exactly one press conference the day he was installed. Wow. No other interviews given to any reporters under any circumstances.
I remember starting the Gordon B. Hinckley interviews with Mike Wallace and trying to become sort of a public face for the Mormon Church so that people might perhaps be more sympathetic to Mormons who didn't know them as well as they could. I want to return to the scrutiny of the Mormon Church under the tenure of President Monson. But before we do that, let's talk about what he leaves behind, his legacy, what he'll be remembered for, and in particular by members of the Mormon faith. Did he change the church in any marked way? Or I guess the question might be, how did he leave his mark, Peggy?
Again, I think most members will remember him as the folksy preacher, but the one big policy change that happened in the church in his years was lowering the age of missionaries from 19 to 18 for young men and from 21 to 19 for young women, which dramatically increased the number of LDS missionaries from 50s up to 70s. The church picked up about 20,000 more missionaries, most of whom were young women. So the influence of the changing role of women, which was also controversial during his era because there was the ordained women movement,
right.
But the fact of many, many more young women serving LDS missions is a social impact we will be seeing for years.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, Peggy, but I think one of the things that sticks out in my head is the focus on the temple built construction, the smaller temples outside of,
No, that will that be was, associated with Hinckley.
That'll be Hinckley. Okay.
Yeah.
And then
it was his idea and also, I mean, obviously President Monson
continued
President Hinckley's legacy, you will. He didn't really initiate any new things except for the lowering the age, as far as we can tell.
You did write about him being a kind of Monson representing a sort of bridge to the past, someone who had been around for some defining moments in modern Mormonism.
Yeah, here's the thing. He was the last man who had been in the room when the church ended its ban on blacks in the priesthood. 1978, the last apostle who can remember that really pivotal moment, because the next man in line, Russell Nelson, was not there yet. So he really was a transitional figure, remembering the old church, how it was when there weren't very many members and not very many temples, to the modern church.
Which has grown pretty massively.
Which is a big in global faith kind of thing.
Just returning to the moments of change and controversy that the church experienced under his tenure, there was a policy that he and other church leaders unveiled in 2015 that drew a fair amount of fire. This related to the children of same-sex couples. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, in November 2015, the church, it didn't really announce this policy. It kind of leaked out a little bit, but the church declared that same-sex, this was after the Supreme Court had ruled that, gays could get married everywhere, ruled that same-sex couples would be considered apostates in the LDS Church and that their children could not have any of those normal rituals, including baby blessings or baptism, until they were 18 and had disavowed their parents' marriage, which caused a huge crisis in the church because not the apostate thing. I guess many members kind of expected that somewhat, but the Mormon Church baptizes and, for heaven's sakes, blesses babies of all kinds of couples. So that seemed really harsh.
A lot of criticism was directed at the church at that time and since. And Monson, you point out in your article, kind of floated above those phrases. He wasn't necessarily the target or even involved in that kind of controversy.
Yeah, the trouble with President Monson's presidency, and this also parallels other earlier presidents, is that ill health and age-related problems began plaguing him pretty early on. So even though that was announced in 2015, or came out in 2015, he had not been really seen in public much before that. So it didn't come from a press conference or anything like that.
Or just say on the local scene too, the church influence has changed the face physically and otherwise of Utah and Salt Lake. You look at the City Creek Center, which was completed and really has had a massive impact on downtown Salt Lake. And also in the legislature, the passage of the non-discrimination law statewide that you can't discriminate with housing or employment for LGBT.
Well, yeah.
And immigration. I would say, you know, the church has taken this kind of counter-conservative view on immigration that, you know, we shouldn't be building the wall. We shouldn't be deporting and splitting up families because of immigration status. And, you know, as Peggy said, Monson really wasn't the face of most of those issues. If you think immigration, it was Uchtdorf that was the church's face on that issue. And
on refugees and actually mm-hmm. Dallin Oaks on mm-hmm. on the non-discrimination.
Yeah.
Harder to see the sort of fingerprints of Monson in the politics and government.
Again, like she said, floating above it.
Right.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Trying to encapsulate a life in a short radio program is difficult. Monson, Peggy, had good relationships with other faith leaders here in the state of Utah.
He's very good at that, yes.
You know what, since we're kind of low on time, I think we should actually turn to it's a kind of a can of worms to open at this point, but the future of the church, we haven't even begun to talk about that. There is an expected successor. This is Russell M. Nelson, the senior member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles.
Exactly.
Is that following a certain protocol? Is this almost a guarantee that he will be the next prophet,
yeah,
seer?
Yeah, this has been the tradition for a century or more.
Okay.
So it is definitely expected that Elder Nelson will become the church president.
He's 93 years old. Is he... You know, is he very different than Monson? And,
yes.
And what can we expect for the future of the church as a result?
I don't know what to expect, but he is 93, but in amazingly good health. The man still goes skiing often. And he, very good genes in that way. He was a heart surgeon. You would never describe Russell Nelson as folksy. He's very learned. He's very knowledgeable. I believe he taught himself Chinese. He's hard driving, achieving guy. Well traveled. President Monson didn't travel so much when he was president, unlike Gordon Hinckley. Elder Nelson has been associated, however, with some of these policies you're talking about, particularly with the gay issue. So there's some question marks about that going forward. And then he also, so we didn't mention that during Monson's era, lots of intellectual questions raging and many millennials leaving over things they read on the internet. And that's a legacy that Nelson will have to cope with. History, etc.
Right, the church sort of grappling with its own history.
Exactly.
Is he a reformer? Is he a status quo person? Change can happen quickly inside of the Mormon Church because of the prophet, seer, revelator status that the leader has. Will it change under Russell Nelson, assuming he takes the reins?
Well, I can't speak to that. I have no idea.
Okay.
All I know is that lots of people have been worried about a particular president, and then when the man gets the office, actually doesn't do all that people feared. So as far as most people would not call Russell Nelson a reformer, but who knows, he hasn't been in a position to change anything. He's mostly perceived as a very conservative. So, but will he be that in the position? Who knows?
Guys, we are unfortunately low on time, and we need to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Peggy Fletcher Stack, if you'd like, I'll give you the honors to start with your own pick.
Well, I was pretty impressed is the wrong word, but the story about the hospital-borne illnesses, five hospitals being fined for not looking at it, not dealing with its own hospital-borne illnesses, which is sort of terrifying to go to the hospital and get sicker.
Right. Things like MRSA, which is this superbug, or getting pneumonia when you go to the hospital. That's an interesting report. You can find it at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, actually, we have a little bit more time than I expected, so feel free to throw in as much underplayed story as you want.
Well, I'm just going to mention one that was in today's paper, and it was a story about a man named Matt Hilliard. And I probably just stole Gerke's underplayed story of the week. I'm sorry, Robert.
That's fine.
But, I covered the legislature for many years. Robert did as well, and so has Lee Davidson. Mm-hmm. And we all knew Matt. He was a fixture up in the legislature. He was the son of Lyle Hilliard, who's actually the longest-serving legislator now on Capitol Hill. And he had Down syndrome. When he died yesterday, he was 42. But he was just the happiest, most gregarious individual you could ever meet. And, you know, he was kind of adopted by the entire Senate. And, you know, if you go on Twitter, you'll see a lot of fond memories of him. And I just thought it was a very touching story.
Robert, you could talk about...
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Matt a little bit, too, just because he deserves it. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, at the end of the legislative session, everybody gets, you know, wound up. Everybody's tense. Everybody's on edge, frayed nerves. And just to see Matt there giving people hugs and high fives, you know, and I you know, you can't... Every year they would bring in a karaoke machine down to the rotunda for Matt's birthday, and everybody would sing a song with Matt. It was sort of the way it was done, and I think Sean Ray has actually posted some video of him doing a rap with Matt. He just kind of I think it was important to have Matt there, and I think it reminded people of that, you know, that they needed to be good above all else, and I think it was important. I think he'll be missed by the Senate and by the legislature, and and condolences to Lyle and his family.
Condolences indeed. Well, for my pick, we still have a couple of minutes here, so if anybody has a second to pick for underplayed story of the week, I'm going to go with a story that was by Tribune reporter Bill Dentzer about. So earlier in the show, we talked about the Senate being the oldest Senate in American history. Right now, we have the youngest Salt Lake City Council in history, following the swearing-in ceremony that took place this week. The oldest member of the Salt Lake City Council is now just 44 years old.
Yeah.
It's an interesting sign about relating to who's getting involved in politics, at the local level in America today.
Well, I think it's also interesting, too, when you look at the makeup of the new Salt Lake City Council, that we have Chris Orton, Amy Fowler, and Derek Kitchen, who are all, openly gay and lesbian members of the council, and then Mayor Biskupski, obviously. It's a very progressive body, and it'll be interesting to see how they get along with the state legislature, because in the past, when Rocky Anderson was mayor, and to a lesser extent when Ralph Becker was mayor, and they tried to take progressive positions, they were frequently swatted down by the state legislature, and so I think that dynamic is going to be interesting as we look at to the years ahead.
I will say one thing about Mayor Biskupski is, you know, she takes a lot of hit on a lot of fronts and relationships with other government entities, but I do think that she has a pretty decent relationship with legislative leaders. She was in the legislature herself, and she has hired Ken Bullock, which was an interesting choice. He's been involved in some past kind of scandal with the League of Cities. But he certainly is a well-known and influential figure on Capitol Hill. So, you know, I think she I would think that she probably avoids a lot of the friction that we saw with Mayor Becker and Rocky Anderson before him. But, you know, I guess that's a prediction, and I can be hung on that. So we'll see.
We've had a rough time with predictions over the past couple of weeks here on the show, but bear with us.
I was not here for those predictions, by the way, about Orrin Hatch.
You floated above the fray in that instance, Dan Harry.
Or below it, maybe.
Next, you know, by next week, I swear I'll have learned to read a radio clock, and we'll have this dial that a little bit more. But Peggy Fletcher Stack, Dan Harry, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, I want to thank you for joining us for this show today.
Great. Thanks. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks as well to Thomas Burr, who joined us earlier. And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Many thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, who runs our programming and operations. Thanks to our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, who broadcast this show across the state, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Join us again next week, and thank you.